It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Marty Appel is with us, author, baseball historian, former public relations director for the New York Yankees, and broadcasting executive. Now has his own public relations business. He's worked closely with some of the greatest names in Yankees history. And, of course, the New York Yankees have won 40 American League pennants, 27 World Series championships. And though they haven't been in the World Series since 2009, the Yankees' presence is felt in every series. Every time someone is approaching a series record, it seems it's held by someone who played for the Yankees. They're a world-famous sports franchise for right at 100 years now, and there can't be many people alive who know more about the Yankees than Marty Appel. Welcome, Marty. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, we're recording on October 21st, which, as you mentioned in our messages, would have been the 92nd birthday of Yankee great Whitey Ford, who passed away recently, one of several Hall of Famers we've lost this year. We'll talk about Whitey in just a few minutes, but you've described yourself as an accidental Yankee fan. Tell me why you call yourself that.
Because I was born in Brooklyn at the height of the Boys of Summer, the great Brooklyn Dodgers teams of the 50s. Mm-hmm. And everybody around me was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. But I was a little kid. I was 7 years old in the 1955 World Series, when the Dodgers finally won a World Series, the only one they ever won in Brooklyn.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I remember feeling terrible, feeling so sad for the Yankees who had lost. My little heart just went out to the underdog, not having any appreciation for the real history between those two teams. So I became a Yankee fan that day, the day that the Dodgers won that 55 World Series. And in that sense, I say my whole life has been an accident because I became a Yankee fan. I went on to work for the Yankees. I still root for the Yankees, but my roots are actually in Brooklyn.
Before we leave that era, tell me about the fan support and fan rivalries in New York in those days. The Yankees, the Dodgers, and Giants were all there. The teams were good, and the Yankees and Dodgers especially met regularly in the World Series. We always heard reports about how you could walk through a neighborhood and hear the radio on as you passed each house if one of the teams was playing. Tell me about what that was like.
It was a magical time. The loyalties were strong. Everybody was aware of baseball. Occupied the national mind. And those were glamorous teams with fabulous ball players on them. And people would proudly identify as, you know, Dodger fan or a Giants fan or a Yankees fan. Moving the Dodgers and Giants to California in 1958 would be like the French announcing that the Louvre Museum is being moved to Madrid. I mean, yeah. It was unthinkable, and yet it happened right under our noses. So, I mean, this was just a couple of years after I became a baseball fan, and I was well aware of the tragedy that this was.
You got started then with the Yankees in public relations at a very early age and in an interesting era in Yankees history. Mickey Mantle was coming to the end of his playing days, and the Yankees' last World Series appearance had been in 1964, as we're talking about the late 60s, and beginning of an unusual dry spell in Yankees history, but still an interesting period in the team's history, wouldn't you say?
Well, I went to work for them in 68, which was Mickey Mantle's final season. And there was a drought. They didn't go back to the World Series until 1976, having last been in 64. But you know what? There was a lot of good baseball. To work for a team that I had rooted for was a wonderful experience. There were some good seasons in there where we thought we were in pennant contention, but it didn't work out. So it wasn't as though it was last place or seventh place every year. There were some exciting times in there, and I look back on those years very fondly.
You handled Mickey Mantle's fan mail, as I understand it, at least in your early days in the PR department.
Yeah, that was my first job.
Yeah.
That was my foot in the door. I was still in college. I was looking for a summer job. I had the audacity to write to the Yankees looking for a summer internship. And I got hired to answer Mickey Mantle's fan mail because it was piling up. It was going unanswered, and the great PR director at the time, Bob Fischel, who hired me, knew this, even though it seemed like a small thing, all this unanswered mail at a time when the Mets were really capturing the hearts of New Yorkers was not a good thing. So I got hired to catch up on all that unanswered mail. I formed a friendship with Mick, and we retained that till he died in 1995. And for a kid who grew up a Yankee fan in New York, what a dream that was.
Now, Mickey Mantle would have turned 89 years old yesterday. He was my first favorite player, and there are a lot of people in my age group who would say that. He, of course, could hit the ball out of any park from either side of the plate. He was often the fastest man on the field. He could go get the ball in center field. But those were his baseball skills, but there seemed to be something else about Mickey Mantle that made him such a baseball hero at that time and to an entire generation of fans. In getting to take care of the fan mail, I know you were very young at the time yourself, but in getting to take care of the fan mail, do you get any insight into what made Mickey Mantle such a hero that seemed like it was beyond his baseball skills?
Well, it wasn't in answering the fan mail, because that was rather mundane. It was, "Dear Mickey, you're my favorite player. Please send me an autographed baseball." Mm-hmm. So yeah. That was pretty much every letter. But to be a baby boomer and grow up in the New York area, or even nationally in those years, everybody knew Mickey's life story, how his father and his grandfather taught him to switch hit, how he was the most powerful player of his day, the combination of speed and power, and he was a great outfielder. He had it all. And as Bob Costas said at his funeral, he was our guy. If he was injured and limping, somehow we were limping too. Mm-hmm. It was the connection between the fan base and Mickey Mantle was so endearing and so strong.
George Steinbrenner became the owner of the Yankees in January of 1973, and he's known for, among other things, hiring, firing, and rehiring managers, especially Billy Martin. But he also went through a few public relations directors too, and you were working for him. What was that like, working for George Steinbrenner?
Well, it was challenging. I mean, you never knew what any day would bring, but you'd get to the office and you'd know something was going to happen that would put us on the back page of the Daily News the next day. So it was exciting in that sense, and some days it was frustrating. But I look back now and I say, the man had the confidence to make me the PR director of the New York Yankees at age 23, and I'll forever be in debt to him for that.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any particularly memorable encounters with him? Did he ever fire you and then you're able to come back the next day, as some people did?
Well, he never fired me, but I remember him telling me one day, "Now, look, I'm not going to put you out on the street over this, but if it ever happens again, you're gone." So that was the closest. That wasn't a good day.
No, that's pretty close. That's closer than you want to come. But but day to day, you're able to go through the many details. There's so many things that fall under the heading of what a public relations director for a team like the Yankees would do. And of course, having an owner like him makes it even more challenging. But it sounds like you were able to at least keep your distance and do what he needed you to do.
It didn't keep my distance, because you asked about encounters with him. I was in his office four or five times each day. Mm-hmm. He would summon us on the red phone, like the bat phone, and off we'd go, the senior executives there, into his office, big round wooden table, and we would sit there, and he would be involved in everything. Like, who's getting parking passes for tonight? What are we doing about women on the flight about the wives on the flight to Kansas City? Everything he was involved with.
That's kind of how we would imagine George Steinbrenner being, but at the same time, for an owner to be involved in those details, was that in a way helpful to you to know exactly what he wanted you to do, or was it meddling in some cases?
I guess looking back on it now, 40 years later, it was helpful. But each day, knowing that you really couldn't get things done until you got the sign-off from him, mm-hmm. could be frustrating. I mean, I can still remember, talking about just the parking passes, game one of the 19, 76 World Series, my first World Series experience as a PR director, I got 400 things to do, and I had to wait for him to approve my list of media who got to park in the media parking lot. So it was, you can, just from my saying that, I think you can feel the frustration of trying to get things done.
Oh, yes, especially with a World Series game waiting for you. Yeah.
Right.
Now, if he's picked out somebody that he did not want to get a parking pass, was that something in relation to something that had been written or said at some point previously, or was there a typical...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, he was, just yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, that was it. Okay, that's what he was looking for.
Yeah.
Well, you've written books about Casey Stengel, Thurman Munson. You've worked with many of the greatest names in the history of the Yankees franchise. You wrote a book called Pinstripe Empire, The New York Yankees from Before the Babe to After the Boss. And that's a lot of time and a lot of history to take on. How did you approach that and eventually get it narrowed down to something you could work with?
I'm glad you asked about that because it was my personal favorite of all the books I've written. There hadn't been a narrative history of the Yankees going back to their very origins since 1943 when Frank Graham wrote one for Putnam. Putnam was doing a whole series of team histories. And the Yankees was the most successful, as you would expect, and got updated a couple of times into the 50s. But there it sat, really hadn't been updated. So in 2012, I wrote Pinstripe Empire, which went all the way back to the beginnings of the New York Highlanders in 1903 and on up to modern days, and it's been updated once since then. So it was a wonderful project because I felt so connected to it. I mean, I had run all these old-timers' days. I had come to know all those old-time players. And to serve as a historian giving an overview to all those years, you also serve as kind of an arbiter as to what belongs and what doesn't, because you can't include everything, and you're certainly not going to include every game they ever played. So I kept it really on personalities and big events and not so much on game results. And the end product was so well received that I'm smiling as I'm telling you about it right now, because it's exactly what I wanted to provide the public, which was this very readable history back to 1903, where all these long-forgotten players come to life.
And there was an interesting history, even in the days, as you say, before the Babe, with Hilltop Park and the Highlanders and all of that. But it was 100 years ago, January of 1920, that the Yankees bought the contract of Babe Ruth from the Red Sox for $125,000. That's maybe still the most important, the most influential deal, business deal in sports history. Give us some background on how that came about and how that resulted.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Harry Frazee, the theater producer who also owned the Red Sox, was actually a New Yorker. He lived in New York, and he was here more than he was in Boston. And he found Babe Ruth's behavior difficult to rein in and damaging to the team. And there were still a lot of fans in 1920 who thought Babe Ruth's way of playing baseball, hitting all these home runs, is not the way baseball was intended to be played, an argument you still hear today, by the way.
Right, exactly.
So there were a lot of fans who were just happy to see Babe go, because that wasn't pure baseball. That wasn't moving runners along and building runs. So Frazee met with Jacob Rupert, the owner of the Yankees, and they negotiated this deal that would send the Babe to New York. Now, I'm sure at the time, Colonel Rupert didn't tell Harry Frazee that the fortunes of our two teams are going to change for the next century. We're going to win every year, and you're never going to win. But that's sort of the way it played out, and the Red Sox didn't win a World Series in 2004. While the Yankees were winning bucket loads of them.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The curse of the Bambino carried for, for all those years until 2004. Give us an idea of the fame of Babe Ruth. In the late 1920s, I guess it's fair to say he was among the most famous people in the world, in sports or out of sports. What made him famous beyond all the home runs, the baseball accomplishments?
Certainly in the United States, maybe Charlie Chaplin and Charles Lindbergh and the president were the only ones more famous than Babe, although I suspect everybody knew all four of them. It was his oversized personality, his willing to do anything for a photograph or a newsreel. Newsreels were very important back then when people were first going to movie theaters on a regular basis. There was no television, and the news that they would see would be what Fox Movie Tone News would put on the screen, along with the coming attractions and, you know, the main feature. And Babe was invariably featured in those newsreels, which focused on celebrities in feel-good moments. So Babe's reputation grew largely through those newsreels and also through the sports pages of newspapers, which is where America turned to its news every day, the newspaper industry. So things are different today, but I think Babe's personality would have won out in any era.
Well, you can't talk about the Yankees without talking about Yogi Berra. He was a great ball player, beloved among fans for really his entire lifetime, including long after his playing career was over. I think you said something along the lines in your book that if there was a place for saints in baseball, that Yogi would be among them. Tell me why you feel that way.
Well, to be a saint, if you're Roman Catholic, you know, you have to have performed a certain number of miracles. I'm not Catholic, so I'm not sure of the number of miracles. It's two or three. And Yogi, well, you know, it's a little farcical, but just from a baseball sense, there was the miracle of his becoming a Hall of Fame superstar player just over his appearance. When he showed up, he was this squat little guy who didn't look athletic at all, and he turned out to be a remarkable athlete, won three MVP awards. Then there was his survival at D-Day in Normandy when he accidentally shot down an American plane. The pilot survived by parachuting out. But Yogi was the only baseball player at Normandy. Then you had his catching Allie Reynolds' two no-hitters in 1952, and he dropped the foul ball hit by Ted Williams, which almost certainly meant that Williams would get a hit on his next try. But he popped up again in the same place, so that was another miracle. And then there was Yogi being a coach on the Miracle Mets of 1969. They're called the Miracle Mets. Mm-hmm. And then returning to the Yankees as a coach in 1976, and the drought ended, and they went back to the World Series as soon as Yogi returned. So there's seven or eight other things I could name that just shouldn't have been and were. So I laughingly say, if there was a sainthood awarded in baseball, he qualified.
I have to go back. I'd known that Yogi was part of the D-Day invasion. I had not heard the story about the shooting down of the plane. What are the details on that? How did he manage that?
Well, he was manning a gun in a gunboat, and what can I say? It was a lot of confusion that day.
Oh, sure.
If you see Saving Private Ryan, you understand the confusion. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, it's a bad story, except that the pilot bailed out and was okay.
Yeah. Now, Yogi wrote, I believe it was in the foreword of your book, about the importance of the Yankees tradition. It seemed like most of the great players had an understanding that they were part of something great. They were great players individually, but they recognized that they were part of something greater than that.
You know what? Today's players, born in the 1990s, they still have that appreciation. I mean, they're not students of history like fans are. Of course, they've heard of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio and Mickey Mantle, but some of them would even have trouble telling you the order in which they came to the Yankees. Mm-hmm. They're just names. They don't really know the facts behind it all. But yet, the magic of that uniform that's not changed, that was the same uniform pretty much that Babe Ruth wore, it's still there. And players today, they would love to be a Yankee, if only for a season, just to be able to be part of that fraternity. And it's a beautiful thing when I get to talk to younger players today and hear them express that.
We mentioned Whitey Ford's name earlier. We're recording on October 21st, which, as you mentioned, would have been his 92nd birthday. He passed away just a few weeks ago. And that he was active as a Yankee at the time when you would have just been developing your interest in baseball. So he, I would assume, would have been one of your early favorites.
Absolutely. And, you know, Whitey was an ordinary-sized guy. He was like 5'10", and nothing striking about him, good-looking man, but nothing, you know, where eyes would turn when he walked into the room. I remember one day we had an event at Bryant Park in mid-Manhattan, like at 42nd Street by the New York Library, Public Library, and then he and I were going to walk to lunch at Rockefeller Center, which was about a 7-block walk. So we walked up one of the most famous streets in America, Fifth Avenue, from 42nd Street to like 49th Street. And I noted as we were walking that nobody recognized him. So I turned to him at one point and I said, "Isn't it strange that nobody has recognized you on this walk?" And he laughed and he said, "It's because I'm walking with you, not Mickey Mantle." If I was walking with Mickey Mantle, everybody would recognize me.
Yep.
So it was a funny observation, and I got a big kick out of that.
Well, Whitey was one of the greats, of course. There's so many. I wanted to ask you about Hall of Famer Earl Combs. He's from our area here, from just south and east of here, in Pebworth in Owsley County, Kentucky, and he was the center fielder on the great Yankee teams of the 1920s. How did he fit in with Ruth and Gehrig and the rest?
I'm glad you brought him up because I talk about him frequently. People talk about center field of Yankee Stadium as sort of being hallowed ground because that's where Joe DiMaggio played and that's where Mickey Mantle played. And I'm very quick to point out to anybody who says that, that Earl Combs, who preceded DiMaggio, was a Hall of Fame ball player, and Bernie Williams, a more modern version, may not be a Hall of Famer, but a great, great Yankee. So that hallowed ground of center field really spans a lot of years with at least four outfielders, not just Mantle and DiMaggio. Combs was a wonderful gentleman. I got to know him because I ran Old Timers Days at Yankee Stadium. So I would always communicate for several weeks leading up to the event to see if they had any special needs or anything like that. And when he would arrive to check in, I was always at the check-in table, I'd sit there like, oh, my God, this is one of the baseball gods. This is Hall of Famer Earl Combs, who set so many club and rookie records when he was with the Yankees. He was a marvelous, marvelous ball player and a great gentleman. And like many of the really good guys in the game, he was able to stay on as a coach long after his playing days ended, so he very much mentored Joe DiMaggio in his role as a coach. He deserves a lot more. I mean, a lot of people don't remember the name, but he should have a plaque in Monument Park at Yankee Stadium. There should have been more honors bestowed on him. The local cable network, the YES Network, probably should have found a way to do a Yankeeography of him, although there's such little footage, it's hard to work around. But certainly a great name in Yankee history. And when Don Mattingly was breaking some of his records, at least his name was back in the news a lot in those years in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Earl Combs went on to be a member of the Board of Regents at his alma mater, Eastern Kentucky University, which is just a few miles down the road from where I am right now, located in Richmond, Kentucky. And there's a building there named in his honor. So he is recognized here in Kentucky, but he was certainly a great part of those great teams. You mentioned Yankees Old Timers Day, and I was going to ask you about that because Old Timers Day at Yankee Stadium is different than it is anywhere else because of the history that we're talking about. Tell me about what it was like to prepare for and be part of actually running and managing that thing, it sounds like, to get those players back, and because the fans really look forward to that.
It's a great event, and for people who love history and baseball history, you don't have to be a Yankee fan to appreciate the gathering of great names that the Yankees represented. So many of the really immortal Yankees have now passed away, the latest being Whitey Ford, that at least to someone my age, I'm in my 70s, that somehow the glamour is not there anymore when Wade Boggs is one of the great players that is introduced. Mm-hmm. It's not like Joe DiMaggio.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you know, as you grow older, and people listening to this should take note of this, the span of years before you and after you, it changes your perspective so much. And when I say that, the 1927 Yankees, on which Earl Combs played with Ruth and Gehrig, may be the greatest team of all time. So in 1977, the 50th anniversary, I was the PR guy for the Yankees. And you know what? I didn't really do much special to honor the 50th anniversary of the 27 Yankees. We did a few things, but we could have done much more. But I was in my 20s. I was so young that going back to 1927 seemed like ancient history. And imposing my own perspective on it, I didn't think many fans would connect with the 27 Yankees. But, of course, there were many fans who grew up with the 27 Yankees who were still around. There were even like six or seven players from that team still around. So I look back now with some regret, but it's also part of the aging process that a 50-year span going backwards, if you're in your 20s, you're going back to prehistoric times.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But as you grow older, the 50-year span isn't so great after all.
Yeah, now we're looking back 50 years to just about the end of Mickey Mantle's career and some of the great things that happened in baseball in the 60s that are still, we think, pretty clear memories to us and would enjoy reliving some of those.
Yeah, so that's an interesting perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Just that, you know, I left it up to myself. I was the PR director. I was deciding on promotions and commemorations. And I look back today and I say, you know, I should have had like a little kitchen cabinet of various ages advising me on what's important and what might not be.
Yeah. One of the great moments in Yankees history, of course, is the Lou Gehrig speech in 1939 when the Yankees brought him back to honor him after he had been diagnosed with ALS, which was known for many, many years and still is as Lou Gehrig's disease. Most baseball fans have heard the statement about it, him being describing himself as the luckiest man on the face of the earth. But there was more to that speech, and you included it in your book. It really is a very memorable moment that happened almost spontaneously as he was surrounded by players and a huge crowd there at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, a little thing that you said, which I need to just finesse a little bit. You said they brought him back to honor him, but he really stayed with the team that whole season as a presence in the dugout in uniform every day, even after he had retired. So it wasn't as though they were bringing him back.
Right, just honoring him that day then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's baseball's Gettysburg Address, they call it. It was a beautiful thing. He didn't even write it down. There's no record of like the Gettysburg Address being written on an envelope.
Mm-hmm.
He just walked up to the mic somewhat reluctantly. He was a little shy about speaking at all. And in that unmistakable New York City accent, he delivered words which are still heard and appreciated to this day. Sadly, the illness that now bears his name, Lou Gehrig's disease, has not progressed much at all in terms of knowing the cause, knowing a treatment. It's a death sentence for those who get it, and we haven't come very far in all these years dealing with ALS.
And, of course, we've mentioned Joe DiMaggio's name. I would imagine you worked with him on some of the old-timers days when you were the PR director, and his personality. We've heard different things about how he could be rather standoffish. What was your experience?
Well, I had a good relationship with him, and it was more than old-timers days because I became sort of the guy to call whenever he needed something. Mm-hmm. And the something might even be, can you leave two tickets for this fellow who lives in New York and wants to go to the game tonight? And, you know, as far as I was concerned, Joe, anything you want, you call me 24 hours
right,
a day.
Sir.
So it was an honor, but also a great pleasure being on the receiving end of those calls and working with him. I know he could be difficult, but I used to say to myself, he's Joe DiMaggio. He's pretty special.
Absolutely, yeah.
Take care of him any way you want.
I wanted to ask, too, about Mel Allen, the longtime broadcaster of the Yankees in the 1950s, with the Yankees winning the pennant nearly every year and lots of big stars on the team. Mel Allen was, if I've got this correctly, making more money than any of the players, which says something about his fame and also about the power that owners had over players at that time. But what made Mel Allen so important to the Yankees and to their fans?
He was a great teacher of the game, so he always had an awareness that each season brought a new crop of fans, age 7 or 8, and he had this way of teaching baseball to those 7 and 8-year-olds without insulting the adult fans who knew everything about the game. So in many ways, I look back and I can remember Mel Allen. I'm watching the game when I was a kid, and it was opening day, and he just said, and remember, when the home plate umpire raises his right hand, that's a strike. And I thought, wow, I just learned something. I'd been watching the game and was not aware of that. So Mel had a way of just teaching you the game, and it was like learning democracy from Thomas Jefferson. He was fantastic. He had this really easy voice. I mean, it was a pleasure to follow. And I knew him throughout his life until he passed away, and he was a great man. I was delighted that I could say that the man who taught me baseball was now a friend.
Another broadcasting-related question in this area. Older Cincinnati Reds fans will, of course, remember Wade Hoyt as the voice of the Reds, and he was an important part of the great Yankee teams of the 1920s and was known for his storytelling ability, and I'm sure you heard lots of that from Wade Hoyt as well.
Yeah, I regret never hearing the Cincinnati broadcasts because he was a beloved broadcasting figure in Cincinnati. I used to be involved in a thing called the Cracker Jack Old Timers Games, which wasn't connected to the Yankees at all. It was an independent function. It was in Washington, D.C. for many years, ultimately in Buffalo. And Wade Hoyt was there one year. And I already had a son, my son Brian, who was probably 6 or 7. And I have a picture of Brian with Wade Hoyt. And I'm saying, someday, Brian, I'm going to tell you who this is and why you should appreciate this photo.
Well, Cincinnati fans appreciated him for many years on the air, and he was a big part of covering Reds baseball back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s on radio when that was the way that you followed your team. This is a big year ahead for baseball. We don't know when we'll see big crowds at the ballparks again, but players and owners have to come up to it with an agreement after the 2021 season. What do you think is ahead for baseball, Marty?
I'm concerned over a lot of things. First of all, good for them that they apparently getting through this season the way they had hoped to. It's been like 51 days since they had a COVID virus positive diagnosis for anybody in the baseball family. So that was the good news. They got lucky with that, and it looks like they'll finish the World Series. Certainly does. But I'm concerned about the future. There were a lot of milestones along the way which I didn't really take to. The pitchers having to face three batters, the runner on second base in extra innings. I mean, they got to do something to speed up the games. The pacing is very slow, but they're making major changes to the game that we all grew up with, and I'm concerned that we're going to recognize this game. My biggest concern is using all the analytics and the positioning of players in the field to determine strategy. And we saw that with taking Carl Morton out of the game the other day for Tampa Bay after 65 pitches. I don't like these trends. I don't like the developments. But I'll tell you the biggest thing I don't like is the embracing these gambling sites now. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the game, and even the broadcasters have to talk about, you know, the odds on this happening or whether they beat the odds or beat the spread on such and such an event. Baseball shares in all of that revenue, and that's going to become as, maybe not as big as broadcast revenue, but maybe bigger than live gate revenue, and I'm concerned about the influence of that.
A lot of issues ahead, definitely. What are you working on currently? What's keeping you busy these days?
I don't have another book project cooking, so I'm just a good fan. I enjoy talking to media about history and about the current state of affairs, as we've been doing. And I write magazine articles and keep current through that means. I'd love to do another book project, but at least for the time being, if the book isn't about Donald Trump, the publishers aren't interested. So baseball books have become few and far between. Mm-hmm.
Well, we mentioned Pinstripe Empire. Where can we find your books? Any other titles you want to bring out to us at this point?
The most recent ones are Casey Stengel, which was the biography of the great manager, Munson, biography of Thurman, and Pinstripe Empire, and they're all available through the normal book channels. Some may be a little scarce, and it may not arrive overnight, but there are ways to get them, and you can begin certainly with Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Well,
but I also want to put in a good word for the independent booksellers, and I hope people will support their local bookstores in their hometowns.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good point. And Marty, there's so much more we could talk about, and we could take it seems like an unlimited amount of time to talk about the New York Yankees, but I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.